Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. My guest today, I'm going to jump right into who my guest is today, because she's so extraordinary and so unusual. Before I even tell you her name, I'm going to list some of her background, and you'll wonder what she's doing on the show to begin with. She's board certified in somatic medicine, consultation psychiatry, board certified in psychiatry. She got her MD from Cornell. She got a master's and a BS in brain and cognitive sciences and systems neuroscience at MIT. So she's a psychiatrist with a special training, actually, in brain and cognition and neuroscience. And she's a miracle. Her name is Kelly Brogan. She's the author of A Mind of Your Own, The Truth About Depression and How Women Can Basically Take Care of Their Lives Better, Reclaim Their Lives. She has a practice in New York City, Kelly Brogan, and you can find her easily on the internet and also on the resource center of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, empathictherapy.org. Kelly, are you there?
What an introduction. Yes, I'm so happy to be here.
I mean, we were talking, folks, before we went on the air, we were chatting, and the more I talk with her, the more I tried to figure out why she wasn't my best friend whom I talk to every day. Because we really should be, except probably we're too busy or something. There really aren't other psychiatrists around right now, other than Kelly and I in the U.S., that we could think of who are really actively involved in thinking and writing about the dangers of psychiatry and better alternatives and who actually have practices. I mean, I can think of one or two others that I haven't been in touch with in a long time, so I don't want to sell anyone short. But if you go to the level of writing a good book like Kelly's really, really working in this area thoughtfully, there really aren't very many of us around. Although the movement that we spearhead is getting bigger and bigger and stronger and stronger and has many, many people from all walks of life, often people who have been injured by psychiatric drugs and shock treatment and hospitalization. Folks who are like Kelly and I, real, you know, well-trained clinicians out of the establishment who really have come to grips with this and who continue to try to offer services. There's not a great number of us. And you kind of brought that home as we were talking today, Kelly. So I'm going to hand the mic over to Kelly Brogan let her just tell you about herself. She's been on the show a while back, and I just want to welcome her back and get her more involved with staying in touch with each other. Kelly, start somewhere.
Yeah, well, it's such an honor, truly, to even be in this level of discussion with you, because in so many ways, you've pioneered, you know, the work that I have now dedicated my life to. And you've been at this, as your listeners know, for decades upon decades, you know, really screaming from the mountaintops, your highly credible and well-researched information. And I think that there is a culmination really underfoot now, and that's what you and I were talking about, that there's really a desperation almost, unfortunately, that's fueling an openness to the kind of information you've been trying to share. And so in many ways, I'm just riding the crest of that wave, you know, where I feel like I have really curated a lot of the available science and information out there that really undermines the guild of psychiatry on the whole, and in many ways demands the cessation of the modern practice of psychiatry until further study, if and when that becomes available. So, you know, I, like you, you know, am very conventionally trained. I come from a pretty blue-collar family. My mom is an immigrant from Italy, and my parents very much, you know, taught me that doctors are deities, you know, that you listen to what the doctor says. And I worked a suicide hotline, actually, at MIT. Suicide is a big issue there. And in my work as a volunteer, I was supervised by a psychiatrist, and I felt so inspired by this idea that we had cracked the code of human behavior, right? And I really fell in love with the idea that there was such a career path, you know, based on the alleviation of human suffering, right? So I always love the fact that, you know, psychiatrist etymologically is like the doctor of the soul, right? It couldn't be farther from the truth in reality, what actually goes on in an average psychiatrist's office. But so I went to medical school to become a psychiatrist, and I've always been very interested in women's health and women's rights and women's advocacy. And there was a burgeoning field when I was finishing up medical school called reproductive psychiatry that amazingly is really specialized in medicating pregnant and breastfeeding women. And this became ever more necessary specialization as more and more women were entering their reproductive years on various psychotropics. And so that was my specialty. And it really wasn't until I was in my fellowship, I was pregnant myself. And I remember, and again, as someone who absolutely believed that perfect health was always just one prescription away, right? I was writing a prescription for Zoloft for a pregnant patient of mine. I myself was pregnant. And I remember this little voice inside me saying, I would never want to take this medication as a pregnant woman, right? And I was like, well, who said that? So I had this weird feeling, like, how could I feel that? Meanwhile, I'm writing these prescriptions on a daily basis. And so I sort of just ignored it. And it wasn't until I was 9 months postpartum, I was really struggling, a lot of forgetfulness, super fatigued, really not myself. And I had a practice at the time, finishing my fellowship, and I was double booking patients and really, you know, not on top of my game. And at a routine physical, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is a autoimmune thyroid condition. And my numbers were pretty much off the chart. And that same little voice came up again that essentially said, well, I don't want to take a medication, right? Like, I don't want to take Synthroid for the rest of my life. There's got to be a way out. And I knew that conventional medicine had nothing to offer me, endocrinology, right? And I somehow had the intuitive hit to seek out a naturopath, which was very unlike me to ever do something like that. I'd only ever been taught that alternative medicine and naturopathy was a bunch of, you know, quackery. And so I did that because I think I suspected that there was another way to approach this. And long story short, within the space of a year, I put this condition into remission. And it raised a lot of red flags for me because in my conventional training, I had been taught that, you know, lifestyle and nutrition bears no part in chronic disease, and that chronic disease is there for life, and you need a pharmaceutical product to help manage it into submission, and let go of any prayers that you might live without it. And so here I was, having put it into remission in ways that I taught, you know, was taught were totally invalid, and I, you know, had a nice flare of skepticism. And around that time, I was given a book called Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whitaker, and you know, he essentially investigates a lot of epidemiology, and he looks at, you know, how is it that we have ever-escalating rates of mental health disability the world over, while we also have ever-escalating rates of prescription treatment. And he goes through all of these studies I had never heard about in my entire training, and I've always been a data nut. My nose has been in PubMed.gov for, you know, 15 years, and I'd never, ever read a single one of these studies, non-industry funded data. And so this really began to, you know, I developed quite a rageful countenance. And I, you know, I really went out on a mission to learn everything I could. That's when I began reading your books, when I began reading, you know, Joanna Moncrief's work and Irving Kirsch's work, and really trying to formulate my own opinion independent of what I had been taught around, you know, the practice of psychiatry. And I put down my prescription pad. I never started a patient on medication again. And I commit myself to that to this day. But I do a lot of work and a lot of prescribing, actually, around medication tapers, which has also further confirmed that there were untold concerns, you know, that I never learned about in my training, and largely around the habit-forming nature of these medications. And I sort of learned the hard way, as I was telling you, that when I started to take patients off of medication after I read that book, I was essentially running an outpatient rehab. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, you know, in terms of how my patients were, you know, struggling and suffering in the wake of medication discontinuation. And of course, we were taught, you know, in our training that that just is their symptoms relapsing, right? So that just means they needed to be on medication, right? And I knew that that's absolutely not what was going on. And I knew that this was a complicated withdrawal. And it wouldn't be for another couple of years. You know, I think the first paper I saw truly systematically looking at the physiology of complicated antidepressant withdrawal was maybe in 2014 by Giovanni Fava's group, and I began to feel confirmed that what I was seeing was not, you know, in my patients' heads, right? And it wasn't just relapse of illness. And so I felt through my own healing journey, you know, I felt very focused on the power of healing physiology and optimizing bodily health, you know, as a tool to help move patients through the taper process with greater resiliency. And so I began to foreground that kind of work in my practice, while also cultivating, you know, my own sort of perspective on the psychospiritual. And, you know, we can talk more about that, but that's sort of what led me here to my very unconventional little niche. And as you said, you know, one that's in desperate need of greater population. We really need more people here in our corner.
Wonderful to just hear your voice and hear you talking. Now, in Manhattan, where you are, there are millions and millions of people. You're the only psychiatrist I know in Manhattan who takes the viewpoint that you're espousing. And you have some therapists that you have found who are reliable?
I've struggled. I continue to struggle with therapists because many of my patients, of course, you know, come to me on medication, most actually, and in psychotherapy. And so as you well know and have written about, you know, psychotherapists in many regards can come to perceive themselves as medication police, right? So they really have so much liability driving their care for the patient that when there is any degree of struggle around a medication taper, the first instinct is to tell them that they need to, you know, abort the taper. If there's even a discussion of the possibility of a taper, many therapists will often interfere with the discussion and suggest that it's not a good idea or that they don't recommend it. I can't tell you how many patients come to me medicated because their therapist, their psychotherapist, was the first person to suggest that they consider medication. And I, you know, I find that incredible. I mean, if you really believe in your craft, you know, how would you ever get to a point where you feel that that medication is necessary? I don't know. So I've really struggled to find people of like mind who support a patient's right to a new chapter for their mental health treatment and are committed to the sometimes scary place of medication tapers. And I've only recently, you know, begun to work with really some of my own friends who are psychotherapists, mostly social workers, who have been inspired by, I guess, my perspective, and who are very open now to supporting patients through what really is a journey, right? But it's challenging. It's challenging because there's so much fear that drives the treatment of the average patient.
Wow. I mean, our experiences are so, so similar. I like to compare therapists who refer their clients for drugs to men who give roofies to women who don't want to date them. because therapy is like a friendship. It's a relationship, yes. Hopefully a loving relationship, and with a lot of respect for boundaries that make the affection possible, because you don't touch and you don't date and you don't have lunch together and you don't expect your patient to heal you. So when therapy doesn't work, it's certainly at least as much the responsibility of the therapist if it's not going well as the patient, at least as much. And when a therapist isn't succeeding with a patient and suggests they go get a drug rather than get another therapist, it's very much like dating. And if the date doesn't work out right, you drug them.
Right.
Because it's a kind of way of saying, you know, I'm going to be with you whether you know it or want it or even can figure out what's happening.
Right. Yes.
It's true, isn't it?
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And I would add, you know, and I'm sure you've observed, because anyone who does the kind of work that you do has to have developed a kind of fearlessness and a deep compassion for, you know, the human experience, right? So I think that there's so little tolerance, and this is societal, right? You can't just blame therapists. This is a sociocultural phenomenon. There's so little tolerance for struggle and suffering, right? That our mandate is, you know, functionality, get back to work, keep punching the clock, you know, keep making your kids' lunches, you know, make sure you don't have to take any sick days. And if that's our priority for our experience on this planet, you know, then of course there's no room, and we're going to reflexively react any time a patient is moving through a challenge. But, you know, you and I know that growth and evolution only comes through, you know, challenge and sometimes suffering and sometimes struggle. And when you can show yourself that you have a capacity to meet those challenges, then you grow and expand in your consciousness. And so if you're working with a therapist who's really more afraid of you than you are of yourself, you know, that's not going to be a healing relationship. And they're sending you that message if, when you're having a challenging experience, the first thing they do is send you off to the doctor. You know, this is how we have all of these incidences of, you know, really tragic outcomes with patients who were medicated and then went on to do heinous things like murder their children or their spouses because of medication-induced akathisia or reactions, right? This is what happens, is we end up medicating people for day-to-day distress. And then their entire lives are changed because of it, you know, because their dog died, or they're having marital challenges, or they're moving through some difficulty at work. You know, if and when I was a medicator, you know, the lifestyle in New York is extremely stressful, and my patients are often working in lifestyles and at jobs that are not, you know, suitable for them, and they are often medicated for that reason, right? So we're not even getting to the level of criticizing the DSM, we didn't even need to get there before we have a big problem, which is medicating people without even consideration of looking at, you know, any criteria. We're just medicating them for experiences of distress and struggle. So it can be a very slippery slope.
I really like the way you put it, that you're your patient's more afraid, your therapist or your doctor's more afraid of you than you are. And this is so true. I mean, one of the things I try to teach therapists is if your patient's having an emergency, you're not supposed to have one. You're not supposed to react like it is an emergency.
Exactly.
You're supposed to react like you two together can handle whatever comes down the pike.
Yes.
And I welcome people telling me they're suicidal. It means we get to talk about it. It means they're alive. Yes. It means they have feelings. And even violent feelings, you got to be able to welcome it and say, you know, we can figure this out. We can find out why you're overcome with these feelings and driven by them, and you can learn to replace them with love and engagement and caring and move on. But if you're the therapist and you hear your patient's feeling suicidal, and you immediately say to them, "Well, I want to refer you for medication." When there isn't even a medication approved for helping people with suicide. They all got, so many of them now have big black box warnings. We cause suicide. There aren't any big green box statements. We'll help you with suicide. So it's a bizarre situation. I really like your just putting it out there that the therapist gets afraid of you and your feelings and sends you to the psychiatrist, who's afraid of everybody's feelings and will surely drug you.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, the analogy I've used is it's sort of like, you know, as a patient, if you're falling off a cliff, you know, sending somebody to medication is like handing them a knife to hold on to, you know, like on their way down.
Oh, my
gosh. There's actually a very real possibility that doing something is worse than doing nothing at all, maybe, you know. So we're in this predicament where we all have colluded in the consensus that doing something, meaning medicating, is necessary because we don't feel we have another option. But, you know, again, you and I both know that actually, you know, using these medications often could potentially result in exactly what it is that you're trying to avoid, which is a tragic outcome. So,
absolutely. And it's so important, as you just did, to distinguish between, quote, doing nothing and refusing to do meds. Because when we refuse to give medication, say, well, that's not what we do. I say to people, if you want to get meds elsewhere, that's going to be the easiest thing you can do. You can stand on any street corner and find meds.
Yeah.
You can call any doctor and get meds. So I'm not depriving you, but I don't think it's your way. The real way is for you and me together to help you get more power in your life and to take charge of your life and to get what you want out of life. That's not doing nothing. That's doing the work of learning to live better. And it's a good hard work, and it depends on relationship hugely, on the quality of the relationship between the therapist and the client or patient. So it's doing a lot. It's not doing nothing. God, people who are giving drugs, in a sense, are doing nothing. Ginger refers to it as nihilism. They're really saying that there is nothing that really helps when they give drugs. And it's nothing important.
Right. Absolutely robs you of any degree of agency and puts you in a dependent position for life, right? Because I don't know of many psychiatrists who say, well, now is a good time to consider coming off that medication I started you on, right? So it really ends up being a commitment to a certain type of psychological, if not physiologic, dependency on a system that you have outsourced your human experience to. And of course, nobody looks at it that way. But that's, that's the importance of really seeing the science of what is behind the scenes, behind the veil, around the dangers and real inefficacy of these medications. It makes committing to them lifelong seem even more absurd, right? So, absolutely.
Well, it's so refreshing to be talking to you. That little voice you heard, where's that little voice coming from, do you think? And how far back does it go in your life that you had the first inklings of a really better view of life?
That's funny, because I think it actually it comes from a sort of a place of righteousness, right? Like I've always been, I come from Irish-Italian stock, and I've always been, you know, a bit of a hothead, you know, sort of know-it-all. And I am a very righteous person. Like, I'm very committed to my opinions, and I've always liked to do things my way. And so this, you know, has been my sort of more, I don't know, adolescent temperament that really bumped up against the, you know, the grindstone of life only even in the past 5 or so years, where I've begun to sort of soften my edges and develop a more spiritual awareness and, you know, dedication to personal growth and evolution and gripping things a little bit more loosely. But it really came from that place, you know, of never really wanting to listen to authority. I struggled a lot. And, you know, every job I've ever had with a boss, I've struggled. I struggled in my training, always getting myself in trouble because I've had a very strong inner compass, you know, that's told me what I need to be doing when. And I am the type, you know, who needed to go through the conventional training. I needed to do every single thing I've done to be able to commit as strongly as I have to the path that I am now on, where I wake up every single day and I know that I am put on this earth to help generate greater awareness around, you know, health freedom and options around, you know, engagement of, you know, resolution of suffering and struggle. So I needed to sort of do it this way. I couldn't have been somebody who just, you know, I don't know, somehow knew as a teenager that I was meant to sort of help heal people in, you know, a sort of more natural way. I think I needed to go this route. So it served me. And in some ways, it's a message to patients who feel regret and remorse. I know you probably work with them as well, around having ever chosen to take medication, right? They wish they knew better before they ever chose to take medication. But it's, I think my path is, if anything, is a model of, well, you know, sometimes we have to go through something that feels, you know, right at the time, and we look back and we realize it was, you know, absolutely at odds with what we now believe, and we just needed to do it in that order to be able to learn what we needed to learn.
Yeah, and I think that's a wonderful approach to take. The underlying tragedy is that many people will never know who they are because of psychiatry and the psychopharmaceutical industry. And of course, folks, it's not just psychiatry. Most drugs are given out by non-psychiatrists, GPs and even nurse practitioners and so on. But it's psychiatry that has lent authority to the psychopharmaceutical industry and the whole pharmaceutical industry, which is so taking over our whole national well-being. Yeah. It's been every administration has taken more and more money from the pharmaceutical pharmaceutical industry. That's how Obama got his health care through. He agreed never to impose any kind of control over the pharmaceutical industry, even though they were dealing with the government. There'd be no bidding. They could just raise prices. And every administration has, in its own way, been so deep into the pharmaceutical industry and its money. And I think it's affecting even the way our children think about themselves, because they see the drugs being given to their friends by the doctors. Then they see their people taking drugs from the plain old, you know, street dealers and so on, and their friends. More and more, I think there's just going to be fewer and fewer people with an inner compass. I love that word you use. It's, of course, not new, but it's a good phrase. We are really destroying the idea of an inner compass for our youth. I think it's a natural part of adolescence to be the way you describe yourself. It's certainly how I describe myself. I mean, the two of us were determined, it sounds like you were too, to be the very best there could be according to the rules. Exactly. And at the same time, we didn't believe in the rules.
Right, exactly.
Well, there's got to be a lot more young people like that. who have that potential to master the rules, to master the existing knowledge, to see through it, to be skeptical, to want to grow and make a new contribution. But I think the whole Western culture, I'm sure, I don't imagine Eastern is doing any better, but the whole Western culture is just moving toward a conformity that is astonishing. Yeah. And your experience, too, that it's all sort of tied together?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it's interesting, right, because there's a banned TED Talk. I don't know if you've ever seen it by Graham Hancock, where he talks about how there are so many consciousness-suppressing drugs and substances that are legal in America, you know, whether it's alcohol or psychiatric drugs, and that in many ways this is in the service of a capitalistic society that seeks to prize productivity over the human experience. And so, you know, you could wonder about how it is that, psychiatric drugs, how and why are they different from street drugs? You know, is Adderall different than a street drug? You know, is so many of the consciousness-altering medications sanctioned by psychiatry, what distinguishes them from what we consider sort of more dangerous substances? And a lot of what distinguishes them in my book is that they have this very consciousness suppressing effect, and it's very insidious. But patients will tell you, you know, they feel numb. They feel this really narrow bandwidth of emotional experience, and it happens to potentially be adaptive for them to maintain they're sort of keeping their head down and one foot in front of the other type of living. But is that really what we're here for, right? Like, are we here to just function at work and until we die? I think many of us have this deep sense that we're missing something, we're missing out on something, and that our whole lives are going to pass us by without ever grabbing onto it. And so a lot of what, when I work with women in my practice, I'm working with, I sort of see it as my business to escort them through a transformation. And the transformation is not always pretty. You know, my patients, when they are off medication or even sometimes in the process of coming off of medication, you know, they begin to wake up to their existence. And sometimes they decide with a feeling of empowerment, to leave their husbands, to change their jobs, to adopt a baby, you know, to move off to Europe. And they do this because they're ready to address a skeleton that's been in the closet for sometimes years that they felt they needed to just compartmentalize because they didn't have the room emotionally or the bandwidth or the support or the belief in themselves to address it. So these types of sort of rocking the boat in this way, you know, it's not supported, again, by our culture that only values profit over human experience. And I often say, you know, I went through a long period of really feeling like my enemy was the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, even when I got my book deal, I thought, well, I'm going to send this book to the heads of every pharmaceutical company, and I'm going to make sure that they see it. You know, that was sort of my initial rallying cry. And you know, I've sort of shifted my perspective on some level because it's a business, right? No one ever said that the pharmaceutical industry is in it for our well-being. No one ever positioned them as altruists or philanthropists. It is a business, and they are working for their shareholders, and you know what? They're doing a damn good job of it. And if that's all that they wake up to do every morning, then why are we suspecting that they would self-regulate? Why are we asking in any way, you know, that, you know, they do things differently or not hide data that is at odds with their bottom line? So once we can see that as the truth, it becomes much more easier as consumers for us to see that maybe we shouldn't listen to everything that they have to say, and maybe we should develop a little more skepticism around their messaging, and maybe we should see who it is that they are, you know, manipulating or whose ear they're whispering in, because we now know what it is that they're after, right? But it's like somehow because of the early collusion of the pharmaceutical industry with medicine and government, it was almost like they allowed, it was almost like they took on some of the more sanctified energy of those authorities, right? There was almost like they were anointed by the American Medical Association very early on. So we trusted that they all had our best interest at heart. And that's what we need to wake up to. You know, that's what we need to disabuse ourselves of, because once you do that, you realize, you know, the information's out there. I mean, your books have been out there for many, many years now, right? So if you're ready for the information, it is out there. But you have to understand that there's a need to inform yourself first, right? So that's the first step, that there is an urgent need for every single person to inform themselves before they engage, you know, in the conventional medicine system.
This is very, very interesting. I have maybe a slightly different slant than you, but I think we come out awfully much the same. I don't think it's per se the profit motive. I don't think it's, I mean, everybody's working on a profit motive. The plumber who's in my
right.
building right now works on a profit motive. But he is a tradesman. He has values. He has ethics about, you know, not replacing every toilet with a new one, fixing toilets. He even has an ethic where he tries to push water conservation toilets. I don't think it's basically the profit motive per se. The profit motive generated individualism and freedom. It's a part of the founding of this country. I think you're really on the truth when you talk about government, politics, medicine becoming one. And I don't think it's necessarily a characteristic of capitalism, but of big government, that once you have big government, it wants conformity, it wants control, and everything is sucked up into it, so that whatever industries gain power basically vie to control the government or get the most out of the government they can. And it really is a form of fascism, and that is increasingly, I think, what we have in this country. I don't think the left is any better than the right on these issues, or maybe even worse. In my political work, I've never found that what we would call the liberal and progressive community wants to do anything about even the simplest thing, like the drugging of children. Mm-hmm. When they used to be Hannity and Coombs, who used to be on Fox News, it was Hannity who came, who would have me in to talk about how it was wrong to drug our kids because of family values. And it was the liberal
right.
Coombs who would say, well, you know, it's relative, you need some help, and these are diseases
right,
or
right,
whatever.
Right.
So I don't – be careful, I think, about attributing it to capitalism. It's capitalism and the government working together.
Mm-hmm.
The pharmaceutical industry spends a fortune on big government, makes big government bigger. The psychiatric medical industry makes big government bigger and better. And I don't have, I think there are more roots of resistance to this among conservatives than among people on the left, in my experience, because at least they're going to say you got to have a moral compass, you got to believe in God, you got to have a certain kind of sense of responsibility, whereas when you get into more relativistic thinking on the left, there's less and less of something to hang on to to say this is wrong to drug people or wrong to lobotomize people. I'm sure is a different viewpoint from the one that you're familiar with, but I think that it does ultimately come down to the fact that once you have government supporting industry and inviting industry into the halls, whatever the industry is, it's going to take monstrous advantage. The FDA is as big an enemy as we have of ethical medicine, because it makes believe that it's approving things in a reasonable way.
Right.
And
right.
It's not.
The illusion.
It's
right.
an illusion. So I would just modify a little bit and say this picture is maybe worse and more complex. It isn't just a profit motive. It's because in all societies that succeed, people are struggling to support themselves and their families. Once you get into not having a profit motive, you get the government determining where things get distributed. You have communism. So I have a somewhat different overview. Yeah. I would say, though, that you're nailing it down when you say, you know, it's the government working with medicine, working with the pharmaceutical industry, and then fighting the one counterbalance there is, which is the legal system.
Right.
And here the right has no idea about it. They just want tort reform. And the left has a better idea because they realize that supporting, you know, the ability to sue is very, very important for the checks and balances. But it's really a massive collusion that's really taken over everything now. You know, we were talking earlier about how your publisher thought you'd be able to get on all these big TV shows and so on, and how they've actually been shut down now. Things are getting worse and worse, folks, in that regard. I used to be on major TV all the time.
Right.
Now that they get all their money from the pharmaceutical industry, I rarely get on. And believe it or not, what I tend to get on is Fox News, Fox Business Channel.
Yes, yes.
Although they're shutting that down too, I'm sure.
Yes.
No, I don't know. What do you think? I've gone off a little bit on.
No, I listen. I'm at a point where there is no perspective on the state of affairs in this country that shocks me, you know, basically. So I am very interested and open to many different perspectives. You know, I have philosopher friends who write about how it is that we got into this mess financially, economically, medically, you know, and again, psychospiritually. How is it that we've gone so far off of the path we deserve to be on? And so I'm very interested in many different perspectives on the situation. And, you know, you don't even need to look at these entities as colluding, right? Because we can see the revolving door, you know, between the regulating agencies. I mean, this is very true for the CDC as well, regulatory agencies. The heads of those become the heads of pharma and vice versa. And so it's all just sort of almost an illusion of these separate
guilds.
And that's highly problematic.
Talk about psychospirituality. Please, by the way, folks, Kelly, I want to remind you, is a psychiatrist, trained as a psychiatrist like myself. And her name is Kelly Brogan. I've gotten so involved in this, I haven't really caught people up. And her book is A Mind of Your Own. You really ought to read it. A Mind of Your Own. It's directed at women, but really at all people.
Sure.
And it talks about the alternatives to drugs, the better ways of life. Kelly Brogan, Brogan. Kelly, talk about psychospirituality. I was among the earlier people to use that term way back in 1991 in toxic psychiatry. Tell us more about that. We've done the hard part of politics. Let's do the easier part.
Right. Oh, yes. So as is probably not surprising, you know, given the way I painted my general mentality, you know, growing up and through the better part of my early adulthood, you know, I was an atheist, you know, raised Catholic and went off on my own, did not get confirmed, and decided that I didn't believe in God. I knew he didn't exist, and that any allusion to anything related to, you know, meaning, really of any kind. Of course, it was convenient that, again, I became a psychiatrist, and we could call that referential thinking, right? So any reference to meaning was a sign of weakness. And so this is where I was coming from. And in my sort of exploration of this, you know, sort of deconstruction of all of my beliefs and assumptions, I began to look at that as well, and I began to hold a little bit more gently onto my atheism, and then, you know, I experienced a series of, as life, you know, hands you them, a series of losses and challenges. I had a mentor, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who's a holistic cancer doctor here in New York City, who was a, if you don't know who he was, incredible renegade, pioneer in that realm, and, you know, fierce advocate for non-interventionist medicine and non-pharmaceutical approaches to cancer, had outcomes that, you know, literally have never been documented in medical history before, and he had hundreds of them, you know, metastatic pancreatic cancer alive in his practice 34 years later, when if they took the standard chemotherapeutic approach, they would be dead in 18 months. So, you know, I had the great privilege of working with him. He died very suddenly. It was extremely tragic for me, probably the hardest thing I've ever had to deal with. We had a very deep relationship, and that's, you know, I was brought to my knees. And again, I've been very involved in activism, anti-pharmaceutical activism, and we had a lot of sort of seeming failures in the past couple of years around legislation, and I really felt hopeless about the possibility that the world could ever be a better place in my lifetime, or for most importantly, my children. And this is the kind of, you know, dark night of the soul that many of us move through before we open up to ourselves, you know, before we open up to our own hearts, we open up to an experience of trust in this process of life and shed so many layers of fear. And so that was really sort of the space that I moved through to understand the richness of life, right? So that it's not just about functioning, and that it's not just about success and ambition, and it's not just about being right all the time, you know, that there's so much more when you actually embrace all of the, you know, texture of life. There's so much more joy, right? Like your highs are so much higher when you can actually allow space for some of this struggle and pain and suffering and grief. I mean, right, like the DSM-5 has just pathologized grief. If you're grieving for more than 2 weeks, you know, Prozac is your answer. So it's really profound, you know, how psychiatry speaks to us about what the human experience is supposed to consist of. So, you know, the modality that I and technology that I have found personally the most resonant, it's quite an ancient one that, you know, you mentioned having heard of in the 60s when it came to America, which is Kundalini Yoga. And there are, you know, some 5,000 available meditations and what are called kriyas, which are specific sets of movements that are designed to induce a state of bodily awareness and shift. And I have found it absolutely life-altering. You know, I'm a completely different person since developing a daily practice than I was before I had ever heard of it. And, you know, I had been doing vinyasa yoga for 20 years, and I never really got much out of it personally. So this is a very different type of experience of yourself, of your mind, of your spirit, and it's very much the yoga of awareness. And so I've come to really embrace that as a tool for someone who otherwise might struggle to sit down and meditate or not even really want to think about doing that. It's very active. So it's a good tool for someone who otherwise has sort of too much of a busy mind to think that they could ever benefit from meditation. And I bring that, you know, I did teacher training, and I bring that to my patients as a tool, you know, again, for beginning to trust themselves and to come into a fuller experience of what their life can look like, even if it might involve moving through a space of looking like something different than what they want it to. So I know that there are so many ways to access this space. You know, the work that you do in sort of like, you know, creating a context for a person's narrative is incredibly powerful, and I just think it's so essential, you know, that we find a way to honor the human experience in a very different language than has been offered through the media and through conventional establishment.
How many years have you been doing Kundalini yoga?
Just two, actually.
Wow.
I'm when I get into something, I dive right in. So I probably did it for a couple of months before I knew that it had something powerful for me in it, and I decided to do teacher training, took a very deep dive, and I have a, you know, daily 45-minute practice every single day before dawn, and in a million years, I would never have believed that I would ever be doing something like this. I mean, it's so funny to me even now, because I couldn't be motivated to find 5 minutes to meditate my entire life. So the fact that this daily practice is, you know, so important to me, it's almost like a little gem I keep in my pocket that I feel like throughout the day, you know, and I just, it's like a very grounding experience to know that I've spent that time with myself, and that I'm working to be in contact with my intuition, which is really the only guide I trust anymore. I certainly don't trust my brain and my mind, you know, always to make the right decisions and in, you know, the challenges of life. And so I seek to get in touch with my intuition, that inner compass, right? That I had no idea was even there my entire life, because I've always been working from my intellect, you know, to try and tell me what to do. And it's not always the best judge, because our egos really can get in the way if they're unexamined, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. You sound wonderful. So whatever you're doing, you're
something
just amazing.
Maybe working,
you
I
sound
don't know.
Wonderful.
I appreciate that.
We have about, you know, 8 minutes or so left. And I want to make sure that you get to talk about everything you want to talk about today. Any more thoughts about, I mean, one thing I'm interested in is if somebody were to come to see you and say they weren't on psychiatric drugs,
mm-hmm.
And they walk in your office,
yes.
What would it look like? What would the conversation be like? How about that?
Yes, I love that question. Those are my favorite kinds of patients because it's so much easier in my experience to heal and to shepherd somebody through, you know, what has been diagnosed or labeled as a psychiatric condition when they have not touched medication than when they have. And that's not to say that it's not possible, because it is. And you know, I've unfortunately had a hand in scaring a lot of people, apparently, you know, who are on meds and then feel like, you know, they hear about this information and they need to get off them immediately. Of course, that's the last thing I want people doing, is abruptly stopping their meds. So I am always so excited to work with, you know, sort of psychiatrically naive patients, as we would say. So when I meet with a patient who, let's say, is struggling through their own description with what they would call depression or anxiety, although I see patients with diagnoses of schizophrenia, bipolar, OCD, panic attacks, but most of those patients, to be honest, have already touched psychiatry. So I do see most commonly patients who haven't, when they are considering, you know, that they're struggling with depression, and they come in. I have a 2-hour initial consultation where I really get to know them. I am, you know, very interested in, again, how far they have strayed from their most optimal living. And in this way, I think, you know, you and I would both agree that depression is like is a signal of disharmony, right? So it's a sign and a signal and an opportunity to look at what is in disharmony. And I focus a lot, of course, based on my own personal experience, but I focus a lot on physiologic disharmony, because I think that a lot of people, when they're living out of balance with what over millions of years we have evolved to expect, right, a certain type of diet, a certain type of, you know, absence of chemical exposures, 100,000 some, you know, unstudied chemicals in our environment, certain kinds of movement, certain kinds of sun exposure, certain kinds of sleep. You know, these are basic entitlements that the human organism has come to expect that we've really neglected, and we just expect to keep on going as if everything should be fine. And so I really look to assess how far, you know, they've strayed from the path. And so I'm very interested in how it is that some patients can be diagnosed with psychiatric conditions when in reality their body is just trying to tell them that they could be doing a better job at taking care of it. And so some of these very common manifestations are, you know, thyroid dysfunction, which of course is largely environmentally induced these days. I look at a lot of blood sugar instability. I look at specific food reactions, you know, so specific processed foods, including wheat and sometimes dairy. And then I'm really big on the concerns I have about very common medications that have side effects that are psychiatric in nature. And if you didn't know that birth control could potentially be causing your depression, well, you know, you could see getting put on Zoloft for that. That wouldn't make much sense. You know, if you didn't know that acid blocking medications can cause certain micronutrient deficiencies that can then disrupt your cognition and mood, you would end up on a psychiatric medication for what is really a pharmaceutical or iatrogenic, condition. So I really just help patients to explore all of these different possibilities because there might be a very quick fix to what they're struggling with that might involve just optimizing their physiology through, lifestyle change. And if it's none of those, then, you know, the fix can take a little more time, as you know, in terms of exploring more of the psychospiritual realm. But it's all on the table, and my commitment is really to personalizing that journey.
How much time do you spend doing what would look like psychotherapy in a more traditional sense of actually talking with people about their thinking processes and their feelings and where they come from and how they might be getting in their way or being a result of abuse or things like that? Do you do much of what we would call psychotherapy?
Yes. Yeah, so I trained at NYU. It's very analytically oriented. The most progressive form of psychotherapy that we were trained in is psychodynamic psychotherapy. So it's from a space of awareness of sort of the cumulative exposures over a lifetime that can bring us into these potentially maladaptive patterns that we can engage. I know my patients very well. My appointments are quite long. And I love that. You know, I love practicing out off the grid and outside the box because I get to do that. I get to dig in really deep with them and to hold up a mirror, you know, so it's my temperament and personality to be very candid and direct and while also feeling a deep compassion for these women that I have paired with, you know, to move through a sometimes difficult process. So in that sense, I would say I spend a lot of time doing that. But I also, you know, look at myself as a teacher. I also feel very interested in providing information, sometimes really basic and simple information, like, you know, recommending, you know, taking some silent time alone, walking in nature. I mean, these very simple but powerful gestures where you can send yourself a message of regard and self-love that we just don't engage anymore. And sometimes we don't unless somebody tells us to, right? So I think it's sort of a hybrid model in some ways of partnership and teacher that I try to engage with my patients for the most part.
Folks, we're coming to an end on a very good note with Kelly Brogan, A Mind of Your Own, a good person, a good book, somebody I'm going to have on the show more often, and maybe that'll be the way I get to know her better. And you'll get to know her better. Kelly, it's just a joy to be listening to you and to be getting reacquainted again.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's really, as I said, an honor to walk the path that you've paved. So thank you for all that you do and for giving me this time and space.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you very much.